the past is a thing of the past. Communicate now.
Okay, I will communicate now. It's Radio Misterioso here for March, what is it, the 27th, I think, of 2005. And no promises for anything on guests, but the appropriate people were notified. And tonight we have Chris O'Brien back again. Chris, can you hear me?
Not really.
Let me put the phone here, and let me see if I can... How's that?
A little better.
A little better?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, as long as you can hear me.
Yes, that's much better.
Oh, okay, great. That means it's sending back like it's supposed to. I'm hearing an echo from somewhere. There we go, that's better. Yeah, tonight we have on again for a encore, and to continue with what we were talking about last time, Chris O'Brien, author of The Mysterious Valley and Enter the Valley. The second one, I can be just like Art Bell and interview him about, even though I haven't even read it. So welcome, Chris.
If you get a little closer, Greg, it'd be even better.
Let me see if I can move the phone. That would probably help you. Oh, dear. I should have music playing or something. I'll put you on top of the Hunt for 0 Point book here. Maybe that'll help. Is that better?
If you speak loudly, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll keep the phone and the mic together here. Let me see. Okay, that's good. Whoa, that's a little loud. Is that any better?
There you go.
Okay, great. All right. Chris, welcome on again.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And I've got a buzz here on the phone line I can try and play with. That's a very loud buzz.
How's that? Is that better?
No, it's a buzz from my end.
Okay.
There we go. Well, at least I've attenuated the buzz down. Can you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. So, once again, welcome back again, Chris. And we got up to, blood rituals involved in the cattle mutilation, someplace you weren't sure about going into, but we did, and it's got a lot of downloads there on Radio for All. In fact, I think it's passed up the Bill Moore interview, so...
Wow.
I think people want to hear about it. What we had ended up with, I think, was
Well, we did kind of jump ahead of ourselves a little in terms of the actual subject matter,
you know,
some of the lead-up investigative work and research that I did to even begin to point me in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe we should background a little bit what the books are about, maybe for about a minute here to catch people up to your books and the salient points thereof, and then we can lead into this.
Okay. I'll give a brief kind of overview.
Okay, great.
Essentially, I moved to the San Luis Valley in south central Colorado, just above the New Mexico border with Colorado, about 130, 140 miles north of Taos, New Mexico. I moved there in 1989, and quite surprisingly, we had quite a flap of unusual anomalous activity, which run the gamut from Bigfoot, UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, all sorts of pretty wacky,
right.
To most people's sensibilities, pretty wacky stuff. And I engaged in a fairly extensive 9-10 year investigation looking into the extent of this particular wave of activity, which got very intense in the mid-90s. And I wrote two books. The first book was The Mysterious Valley, which covered the first 3 years of my investigation and research, and pretty much dove into the public record in terms of unusual events that occurred. And Very soon in my investigation, I realized that the San Luis Valley may be America's most anomalous region, and I think I did a good job in documenting, researching, investigating a number of thousand of events that lead me to believe in all confidence that that this is a very special area in the country, one of the so-called hot spots. There's a few of them around the country.
Hey, Chris, do you have any idea if your research influenced at all the decision to put for Robert Bigelow to put the National Institute for Discovery Science facility out there back in the, I think it was the mid-90s?
Well, yeah, I think I was sort of caught up in the same curve as Bigelow and actually other people that got involved in the late 80s, early 90s in this proto-science called ufology and paranormal investigation. I personally did not have any direct dealings with Bigelow. I did work side by side in a sense, alongside some of their efforts in the northern Mexico area. But never did actually work for them. They were, of course, were a very, in some sense of the word, a snooty kind of, world-class scientific organization, and they considered me a journalist, so, they didn't have much time for me. But I was able to amass quite a database of unusual events, which I refer to as my report log, which is about 70,000 words, each of the events in this particular collection of geographically specific events. In other words, I only reported on the actual confines of the San Luis Valley. I sort of limited myself, put blinders on for greater activity. But in essence, what I tried to do was really cover the area as thoroughly as I could, and not only look at and investigate UFO-type events, but also unusual livestock deaths, hauntings, strange societal aberrant behavior,
outbreaks of fires,
and weird anomalous meteorological events. I looked at anything weird that was going on in this one particular place, and the first book gives a real good blow-by-blow description of that process of the first 3 or 4 years, and then the second book goes in more into the history of the area, looking at the culture. The broadcast television didn't arrive there until the early to mid-80s. It's a very remote area. I live 60 miles from the nearest stoplight, and I literally covered probably a couple hundred thousand miles around the valley in that 10-year period investigating these claims. Most of the later work that I did from 94 through 99 was working in conjunction with local law enforcement in the area, and I was, in a sense, you could almost call me an unofficial deputy of weirdness for about 3 or 4 counties out of the 5-county area there. And the second book, End of the Valley, goes into some of the folklore and the history and gives a background to the actual arrival of Europeans in the area. It talks about the Native American traditions from this very sacred area at the northeast corner of the Four Corners region, basically. And I also did a bit of research into the pioneer history, the incredible treasure legends, some very famous spook lights and haunted houses and phantom trains and Native American legends of strange creatures. And I really beat the archives, as it were, of Denver Magazine and various, Rocky Mountain News and some of the various publications that have been around for quite a while. And it's really amazing if you start digging and looking for information about a specific place or subject. It's quite amazing what you can find. And I am working on a third book that sort of continues on where the first two books left off and also adds additional more in-depth info and research into the actual cultural, subcultural belief systems that have developed sort of independently there in the valley.
So is there a background, in history there for that being a very strange area as opposed to any other areas around there?
Boy, I'll say. First of all, the earliest incursion into North America by Europeans occurred up the Rio Grande River Valley, which, of course, goes from El Paso all the way up through New Mexico into Colorado.
And when was that?
Rio Grande starts in Colorado, and that whole area has been settled. Well, Santa Fe, I believe, is the oldest incorporated.
When was that expedition up the river?
In the late 1500s, early 1600s, Donate came up with his conquistadores, and one thing that absolutely shocked him and his friars and the generals and or the you know the captains and lieutenants that came up there with him and the troops is that the Indians were already aware that they were on their way, and at one instance, 10,000 Indians were waiting for Onate and his troops at the Isleta Pueblo, all on their knees with their hands clasped, and they had already fashioned crucifixes. And you know, of course, they were the conquistadors were flabbergasted by this, and were able to ascertain from the Indians that they had already been visited by a European, but she came in a blue cloud, and they called her the Blue Lady. And she told them about Christianity, and in some parts of the supposed story, she even brought small liturgical objects like crucifixes and rosaries with her, and was able to communicate with them in their own language. But she was in the astral; she was not. She was a disembodied, like a ghost or a spirit, and quite impressed the Indians. So much so that the Spanish were able to take over the entire New Mexico, southern, you know, southern Colorado area there, take it over and establish 22 missions in I think about 2 years, which was the easiest time they had of subjugating the natives in the New World. And many still equate that incredible 2 year period of progress in establishing missions as being a result of the Indians being softened up by this nun. And evidently, when Onate got back to Spain, there was a very public trial going on of a nun, Marie Jesus from Agreda, Spain, who claimed that she had already been traveling to the New World, where the conquistadores are going, and bringing the word of the Lord to the natives. And she would be seen in the convent in a meditative state for many hours, hovering, sometimes reported as levitating, and wrote a book about it called The Mystical City of God, which described her adventures to this new world and how she was able to bring the word of the Lord to the natives.
And when was this?
This was in, I think she was on trial in about 1610 or something, if memory serves correct. I'm not sure. I need to check my dates. But
I've got to throw a wrench in here, Chris.
Sure.
I referenced the story, and I'm sure you know it, of Cabeza de Vaca, who went through the Southwest in between 1528 or so and 1520.
Right. Yeah. It took him almost 10 years.
Yeah, he was lost for 9 years, and he made it all the way up into as an individual. I mean, he was the only one that survived as an individual, along with a few other people. They were separated, and then finally they...
Well, Esteban, his the black
yes,
sailor.
He made it to Zuni, and the Zunis got tired of him and killed him because he said that he was a god and that they should keep bringing him women and presents and all that. And De Vaca didn't ask for any of this stuff. He was trying to treat them well.
Right.
And so there is a history of at least one white person, European, making it into... The reason I'm saying this is because there's an avenue besides... there's at least
besides
one other avenue.
Maria Jesus Agreda.
Yeah,
yes,
and he wrote this report in the 1530s, and it was...
Right.
People in Spain read it. I mean, it was written for the king, but other people were able to...
Yeah,
read
that's
it.
This is a possibility. Again,
1540s,
he didn't get all the way west, though. He came down the Front Range. He didn't actually go up the valley.
I believe
he crossed the river down towards Texas.
He made it up to Zuni, definitely, because the Zunis knew about him. When Frank Cushing came
that's very possible.
Yeah, late
1800s. Well, one thing
that
you can't take away from the story of the Blue Nun, as I call her, or the Blue Lady, is that she's one of the 12 incorruptibles, and her body is not rotted in 330 years. It's been sitting unembalmed in a glass-lidded crypt.
Uh-huh.
Which is quite interesting. I have one, I think, the only known photograph of her that's been published.
Where is
photograph
that?
Of her
where in Spain is that?
It's in the convent she was in Spain.
Do you know what town?
I think it's in Agreda. Well,
okay.
Wherever the convent was that she grew up. I, of course, I'd have to check my notes. And,
Okay.
Go back and review my own my own research. It's been a while since I covered this material, but I do have a very striking photograph of her lying pristine in her casket or crypt or whatever you want to call it. Two complete scientific examinations, one in 1891 and one in 1991, 100 years apart, were done on her. I think photos were taken there, but I've never seen any mention of them ever being published or available. I actually was able to track down a pretty brash young Spanish journalist who snuck in, was able to wrangle his way into the crypt, and then was able to smuggle out a photograph of her. This type of thing, I'm not even sure if she made it all the way up the Rio Grande and even made it into Colorado. But the whole area around Santa Fe, from Santa Fe north to Taos and north from Taos into the San Luis Valley,
mm-hmm.
Is the earliest incursion into North America by settlers of European descent.
And, right.
Some of the belief systems, you know, over the 700, well, it'd be five, almost six, what, 500-something years, 600 years almost, history of these families, Castilian Spanish families, being in the mountains.
Right.
They've developed their own complete sort of dialect, their own subculture.
Yeah.
The Penitentes, Los Hermanos de Penitente, the Penitent Brothers, they're the most fundamentalist of all Christians. They flogged themselves and reportedly crucified one of their own every Good Friday. I guess we're a couple days late on that one.
Yeah.
A very interesting subculture and belief systems have sprung up in this area that's been settled for, God, almost, you know, half a millennium by Europeans here. And, of course, many of them who intermarried and intermingled with the native population, there's an interesting melding of sort of Catholic, sort of old-school European sorcery and magic with an indigenous, more Native American, system of healing and sorcery and other things. And the marriage of the two have created some very interesting belief systems. One of the early ones that caught my attention was the belief in the area there, northern New Mexico, south central Colorado. If someone sees a UFO hover, they call all their relatives because they, if they see a UFO, they call the relatives because they want to see if it hovers, because wherever it hovers, supposedly you can find treasure underneath it, which is a very unique take on sort of a spinoff relating to belief in UFOs. And supposedly, I mean, of course, these are urban legends in some sense,
yeah.
But there have been rumors in communities that treasure has actually been found in this manner over the years. And, of course, it's always like, well, my neighbor's uncle's dad, you know,
right.
That sort of thing. But you hear it enough to wonder if there may be some sort of kernel of truth at the core of that. And,
well, you saw plenty of things.
You know, actually find treasure in this manner.
You and other people saw plenty of things hovering over the San Luis Valley in the 1990s. Did you ever go check out something like that?
No. Repeat the question, I'm sorry.
I said you and few other people in San Luis Valley, many other people, saw these things hovering around constantly for 10 years or decade
you were
there.
Yeah, most of the time they're flybys. Occasionally you would see them hover. And again, a lot of the hovering was done by the smaller anomalous lights, the glowing orange and red orbs, for instance, the smaller, more light sort of plasma effect type objects were the ones that tend to do the hovering. The larger objects, the more structured sort of metallic objects, always tended to be going somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Although there are some examples, you know, my sighting log of hovering objects. Again, you know, I don't quite know what to make of that particular interesting sort of angle on the meaning that people
right. I mean, it's basically.
I've never actually gone, and you know, I've seen a number of objects hover, but I've never actually gone with a Geiger counter, or rather, a metal detector, and tried to
right.
Up treasure. You know,
more important things to do.
Reminds
when
you're getting it at the height of this whole thing, a dozen calls a day on sighting weights. You know, you have thousands of miles to cover and stuff. I ran myself ragged trying to just keep up with the known stuff for the current stuff, as opposed to trying to create more excitement for myself.
Those orbs actually were some of the things that were hovering around the northern New Mexico Dulce area for the longest time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
same
started
exact
the rumors there.
Globes. Yeah, I've 100-plus sightings of these things. And myself, I've seen, I don't know, half dozen, 10 times probably I've seen these things. Some are pretty close from a fairly close range. I think the closest I got was less than an eighth of a mile of one that by a car I was traveling in. Not sure what they are. Some sort of, I don't know, they don't seem to be like akin to earth lights or some sort of ball lightning or anything. They do zip around fairly intelligently, at least in their appearance and their behavior.
Are they located?
You know, one of them.
I'm sorry.
Every type of ufological description that you can think of has been reported in San Luis Valley from time to time, including this one interesting ship that turned into a cloud that looked like a three-headed wolf and then changed into another animal and another animal before it darted away. And you know, you have a guy who's like a pillar of his community and like high up in the fire department of a major city in Colorado claim this and be missing for 3 days and claim that he had this incredible experience. What are you going to do? Tell the guy? I wanted to know if like Amanita muscaria was growing or some sort of natural Jimson weed or something that this guy accidentally made a soup out of or something, because boy, this stuff that he was coming up with was pretty amazing.
Did it seem to jibe with anything else you'd heard from around there?
Pardon me?
Did his story seem to jibe with anything else you'd heard?
No, kind of stood apart. You know, I've heard some pretty interesting descriptions of events and stuff, but this one was, you know, more of akin to a Travis Walton type thing. I mean, the guy was, they had search and rescue looking for him for 3 days before he stumbled out of the hills. And it didn't make any sense from any standpoint. I you know, you almost had to take the guy at face value, because there was no he had no apparent reason to potentially jeopardize his standing in the community or his reputation or any of those things. I mean,
well, did he?
You know, and he was in an area where it wasn't his girlfriend up on the hill that he was, you know, going to see on the fly or something. This guy was in the middle of BF nowhere, and there was no reason for him to. To come up with a, you know, I think the word would be cockamamie story like that.
Yeah.
You know?
What happened to him? Did he keep his job?
And disappeared back into his life. And you know, I personally wasn't the one to investigate the case. A very good friend of mine did. He was loath to you know, allow himself to, you know, be put in the meat glare of the media and stuff. He just didn't want anybody to know about it. But was willing to at least get the information out to investigator, a friend of mine, so that it would be part of the record. He definitely did that. But you know, as far as getting involved in any further investigative work on it, or he was just not interested. It was pretty freaky for him. So
yeah,
well, it was understandable if even half of what he said was true. He claimed that they were reptilian-looking beings dressed in camo. They were able to cram way more into a small 30-foot ship than could possibly fit it. It's almost like there was some sort of spatial displacement inside the craft, and you know, they had him tied up or trussed up. It wasn't fed, and he was trying to catch insects and eat them, and it's just very weird.
Sounds like those people that say they've been kidnapped by Bigfoot for like a week, which has happened.
Yeah, that
a couple
was only
times.
One guy in BC in the 20s. Yeah, that's very rare, though.
Oh, really? Okay, I thought it happened
that's
at least one other time. Either that or the guy made it up. I don't know.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, the area there just has so much strangeness going on. I one of my real personal favorites is the legend, urban legend in some people's estimation, but I found some documentation of a couple of events, of appearances of a demon or devil, which... you know, the standard story is he'll show up at a dance and woo the prettiest girl in the place, and she'll start dancing with him. He'll be a complete stranger dressed really nicely in kind of old-fashioned but brand-new evening clothes.
For the area.
Yeah, have, you know, a hypnotic charm about him, and he'll, you know, invariably woo the prettiest girl in the place, and then somebody will get mad at him or because she'll start dancing, you know, with reckless abandon and reveal, you know, herself and that sort of thing, and relatives generally are attributed of getting involved, trying to you know, confront this guy, and either his gloves will come off and he'll have claws for hands, or his hat will come off and he'll have horns, or a tail will pop out from his pants, or he'll have goat, one instance had him with hairy ankles and cloven hooves, his feet, and he'll be chased out of the place, and of course as soon as they, you know, he hits the door, he disappears. And
I read some of this in your book, and you said that some of the stuff that happened
going to appear at any time during the year. It would be Good Friday night and Saturday, you know, the following Saturday night. So yesterday and the night before, the two nights that he's most often reported.
Did this happen?
Amazing event that occurred at the at a couple of the Indian gaming casinos in the late 90s.
Okay, I was going to say contemporary.
Okay.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, is there something that happened recently that you know about that somebody went and checked up on?
There was an article that was rather tongue-in-cheek, but I did do some follow-up investigative work and found out that something indeed did happen. They closed down two the Rio Grande casinos down in northern New Mexico because this demonic sort of being was supposedly, you know, going up to people that had just spent their last quarter in a slot machine, giving them a quarter, and they'd hit these huge jackpots, and this was happening, and people were saying, one case had the woman going out to the parking lot to share her earnings with this guy, and he had, like, vertical slit red eyes and a tail sitting next to him on his front seat in his car. She found him in the parking lot in the car, and then another instance had some other, you know, similar type demonic appearance description that that the winner of a jackpot had. And rumor was, and I did confirm that at least one of these two casinos closed down the following 2 days, which would have been yesterday and today, Easter, you know, weekend, and did some sort of secret cleansing or exorcism or some sort of ritual in the casino as a result of these stories that, you know, it happens to one person, then all of a sudden it seems to happen to two or three, that that person wasn't the only one, and then the story rips through the community, and of course everybody hears about it quickly, and the same sort of scenario unfolded during this last wave. I call him Old Scratch, because in the 30s he appeared at a famous bar in Espanola called the Line Camp, and played, you know, the devil went down to Georgia, was playing a fiddle or playing some, I think, piano or some instrument. And something happened to make people suspect that he was not who he appeared to be. And he got into a fight with one of the musicians, and he left, and he scratched the guy in the face really badly and gave him lifelong scars. And so some of the locals have come to refer to him as Old Scratch, but you call him Old Scratch or the Powaki Devil. He tends to center his activities around Powaki, New Mexico, but I have him up 100 miles north in Sanford, Manassas, Colorado, Tres Piedras, Del Norte, even Colorado, which are, you know, much further north. So, I mean, it's very similar to other legends in Mexico and in other parts of the Southwest. But when you start being able to attach names and dates and places to these events, then you start to wonder, well, this can't be a reoccurring hoax like this. I mean, these people are superstitious and all that, but there's definitely got to be something at the core of this. There's some sort of strange event that can't be explained that's then maybe unfolding in this sort of a mythical, you know, I don't know, sort of urban legend sort of fashion.
Yeah, either that or somebody's using the tail to try and either get laid or money or whatever.
Well, generally, he says
it sounds like
to appear during Lent when you're not supposed to be out dancing and partying. That's the, I think, the interesting sort of potentially religious connection. These people are partying sinfully during Lent, and so there may be some sort of cultural sort of guilty conscience collective that's manifesting these appearances or something. Again, it's hard to take this stuff at face value, but when you start to dig into it and you start to realize that, hey, there's actually people whose names are attached to these events. One of my favorite was the uncle of the chief of police of Cuesta, New Mexico, was driving late at night north of Cuesta, south on Highway 522, and saw a woman walking along the side of the road dressed in evening clothes, bright-colored red evening clothes, and he stopped by to see if she needed a lift, thinking maybe she had broke down. She got into his truck, didn't say a word, and he turned to look at her sitting next to him, and again, the description that she had goat's legs and cloven feet instead of, you know, regular legs and shoes. And as soon as he realized, you know, the instant he realized that, she dematerialized from the front seat of his truck. Well, the average person would probably, you know, not tell anybody. He drove instantly down to, you know, the 7 or 8 miles into town and filed a report. And it made them get his nephew up, the chief of police, and actually filed a report. They tried to talk him out of it, and he wouldn't hear anything of it. He filed an official report of picking up a mystery hitchhiker with goat's feet.
Yeah, you did mention that in your book, in the first book.
And, you know, what are you going to do? Tell the guy, I mean, he's a pillar of the community. He doesn't drink. He's, you know, devout Christian. What are you going to tell somebody like that, that they're, you know, maybe he found some amanitas. I don't know.
Who knows? Well, there's many explanations, from the totally mundane to the incredibly fantastic. And in between, it also reminds you of the Chupacabras thing and how it seemed to spread as a rumor, but then people claimed to actually see it and showed people what it had done, and, you know, all through the Southwest, and then it either spread to Puerto Rico or started there, I can't remember, but it spread throughout the Southwest, and then, you know, in northern Mexico, then up into Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, finally made it into California, all the way up into Santa Ana, which is just south
of here. Well, as far east as Florida as well. But most, of course, your Chupacabra reports are from Central and South America.
Yeah, but the...
There was quite an outbreak in the early 90s in Puerto Rico.
And then only in Latin neighborhoods, too.
Yeah, I was going to point that out. That I think that's a real clue for you know, aspiring researchers and investigators out there, that there does seem to be a cultural bias in some of this.
Well, there's
weirdness.
Yeah.
Different cultures tend to report different, consistent things that are different from other cultures.
Yeah, well, it started with the hairy dwarf stuff in South America, where nobody
exactly saw
anything like that up here in the United States in the 50s and connected with UFOs. And
exactly,
they would attack people, chase them. That never happened in the United States.
Right,
or
in Russia, they had huge, like, 10-foot robots.
Yeah, in the 80s. The only one I know is about Voronezh, but I guess there were others, too. The funny thing about Voronezh is that they said the craft had the symbol, the UMO symbol on it, which has been almost conclusively proved to be a hoax, yet this thing in Russia was seen by, I don't know, you know, Jacques Vallée investigated this, was seen by, I think, 20, 30, 40 people.
Right, they had the same symbol.
So there's one to put your hat. You know, we got derailed at the beginning here about the history of the area and the weirdness involved with it. And, you know, Native American and later, conquistadors and settler stories. We didn't quite go into that as much.
Well, yeah, the Native American tradition, of course, is the most secretive and the hardest to research. Fortunately, I've been able to meet some knowledgeable Native Americans who have been willing to at least kind of hint around at some things, confirm some stuff, deny others. But it is very difficult to try to come up with a generalized view that has a tag Native American on it. Each different tribe, whether it's Hickory Apache or Mountain Ute or Southern Mountain Ute or Tewa or Taos Pueblo Indian, they all have their own sort of spin on it. They have their own, you know, sort of tribal version. But essentially what I've been able to ascertain is that the San Luis Valley was considered a very sacred hunting ground and vision quest area, and was the only spot in North America where three major regional groups of Indians overlapped. You had the Plains Indians, the Mountain, you know, the Mountain Utes, and the Native Americans that inhabited the Rocky Mountain states, and then you had the Southwest Indians all overlapping in this one area. Nobody lived there year round. Gets down to 40 below on bad years during the winter. So
yeah,
it's not
smart enough not to live there.
Natives would be not there at, you know, 8,000 feet in the dead of winter. But one thing we can say and mention with some confidence is that the Blanca Peaks area, which is right near the Great Sand Dunes National Park, is considered to be the sacred mountain of the east of the Four Cardinal Mountains, which are,
one of them is San Francisco Peak, isn't it?
The mountain of the west, the San Francisco Peaks, or mountain of the north, San Francisco Peaks are the Mountains of the South and Mount Taylor, or West rather, Mount Taylor is the Mountain of the South, and then between those four cardinal mountains is considered the Four Corners area. Well, Sistan-Jinny, as the Dena or Navajo call the Bonk Peak area, is the most important of those four cardinal mountains. It's a place where all thought originates, and it's also, I've been told by one source, that it's where doorways that move up and down about a 60-mile stretch of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains are centered around the Bonk Peaks area. Doorways are there for cloud people, sky people to come in and out of our existence and go wherever it is that they go and come from. And this is something that's very difficult to pin down, and there's very little written record. This is mostly an oral tradition, but I have been able to get very similar accounts from different people, you know, different Native Americans from different tribal backgrounds that have all kind of generally said the same thing, with different descriptive elements involved.
Have you gone into any primary sources? I'm thinking particularly of people that went in and researched in the late 1800s. I mentioned Frank Cushing before, who actually lived with the Zuni for 3 or 4 years.
You're going to have to speak up, man. I can't hear anything that you're saying.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was saying, have you checked any sources from ethnographers, people that went out in the very early on and first tried to ask the tribes about their traditions and things like that and wrote them up? What I'm thinking of is...
Yeah,
the,
I have.
You know,
there's been very little written.
Because at that point, they're a little less reticent, you know, to talk to somebody because they didn't... instead of somebody telling them to go somewhere and trying to put them in a reservation or chase them around or kill them, they were actually coming in and just asking them about their tradition. So
yeah,
they would have been a little bit more open at that time, I would think.
Well, General Deonta, who was the first governor of New Mexico, was the last governor before the, you know, representing the Spanish claim to the area. He chased Greenhorn or Guerno Verde, who was a Comanche chief, who was doing raiding parties down towards Taos, and the Anza led a fairly large-sized troop detachment up to chase him up into Colorado and kill him. And as they were going up there, the first real main group of Spanish to go into the San Luis Valley, this is in the 1700s, and everybody kind of went, if you got as far as Taos, you were way north, and everything, was Del Norte, it was north of Taos, you didn't go there, that's where the boogeyman was, that's where, you know, nobody went up there, basically, at least Europeans, and so Deonta launched this, attack up into southern Colorado, and in his diary, he mentions Blanca Peak having these strange, rumbling, droning sounds that seemed to be coming from the ground and seeing strange lights flying around in the mountains. So,
no, Taos hum up there in the 18th century.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, something akin to that. Well, this has been, you know, the Taos hum, that's interesting you mentioned that. The Taos hum has been heard up and down the Sangres for decades. And there are stories of strange humming noises from the late 50s and into the 60s that I was able to research. And basically they sound like large generators possibly operating underground, extremely low frequency, but... And not very loud, but very powerful. It's like something huge was making this low, super low frequency noise. I personally have been able to actually hear it a couple of times myself, and it does. It sounds like a huge cement truck, you know, idling down at the bottom of a hill, you know, like a half a mile away. And you can hear this low vibration of this big truck diesel engine idling. And his description of the sound was very similar to that, although it did seem, by his description, to be louder than that, than something that some people could hear but others couldn't. Everybody appeared to hear this. And then, of course, the descriptions of the strange lights that they saw, you know, flitting around in the mountains. Marilyn Childs, actually, who is pretty high up, I think, in the international MUFON, she alerted me to this story. She evidently was turned on to this whole aspect of Deonta's trip when she was in college, and her archaeologist professor mentioned this story to her, and she was able to research this and then subsequently turn me on to this information. And but in terms of the Native American tradition, again, I'm a nosy white boy. I wear a black cowboy hat a lot of times when I'm out, you know, in the field, and I'm just probably the last guy you'd ever think that's going to get anywhere and, you know, proceed with any sort of, you know, headway into the whole Native American tradition. It's a very, very difficult area to research, and I've been fortunate to befriend some Natives and some Hopi and Navajo and others.
I think it depends on your attitude, too.
Yeah, well, if you go into it, you know, trying to kind of capitalize on it and really sensationalize it, you don't have a chance. But if you really, you know, you have to get to know these people before they'll talk about stuff like that. Or you have to get to know the locals anywhere if you're going to be investigating
right.
type of you know, this area of investigation. It just makes people clam up. And the only reason I was able to make as much headway as I did in 10 years investigating the San Luis Valley was because people knew that I was local and that, you know, that I wasn't going to violate confidences or violate, you know, requests for anonymity or that sort of thing. And you know, of course, that does make it difficult for... If I wanted to, like, begin investigating here in Sedona, it'd be pretty difficult until, you know, I gained people's trust and was able to, you know, be a local for more than just a few months. So, yeah, that is a major stumbling block, I think, in a lot of investigative efforts. Linda Howe and Timothy Good and others, Michael Hessman, they tend to float around and try to latch on to this stuff out in the field, and it's very difficult for them to get people to open up because, you know, they're coming in from the outside and they don't really have any tangible connection to the area or the people. So I was very fortunate in that regard with my efforts in the San Luis Valley. And, of course, you know, I did the proof's in the pudding. You know, I really worked my teeth through off getting all this stuff documented.
Right. What was it? I have a list. Oh, you know, now that we're talking still on the subject of the history of the area and what's been going on there for...
On the subject of what?
The San Luis Valley, that area,
right.
And the history and what's been going on there for hundreds of years. Is there any history of animal mutilation going back before you got there, before even that Snippy case of 1967?
Yeah, but there are very, very few. The most striking case that actually was an actual case and not just a rumor or a story that's been handed down and, you know, played telephone with over the decades was a Forest Service worker in the National Forest up around the Buena Vista area. Again, this would be north of the valley and outside of the valley by about 40 miles. But he evidently found in the mid... I think 53 or 54, I'd have to check my notes, but in the early to mid-50s, found a pile of mutilated deer and elk, and I believe the total number was 15 animals. I think 8 of one, 6 of one, 8 of the other, or 9 of the other. I think mostly elk, and then some deer thrown into the pile, and they all exhibited the classic mutilation, you know, signs, soft tissue organs missing, and no, you know, real apparent cause of death. And,
when was that?
You know, strange disfigurement, shall we say.
Yeah, when was that?
He lived into his 90s and was interviewed by two researchers who I rely heavily on for some of my research, David Perkins and Thomas Adams.
Right.
And Izzy, actually, Dave Perkins was able to interview the guy, and if I remember correctly, and knew of him, and he lived into his 90s. I never did actually get to meet him, but evidently he lived all the way past the age of 90 into the 90s, and evidently went to his grave, you know, always wondering what, you know, what the heck could have done that. And this was in the, like I said, the early to mid-50s.
Oh, okay.
Other cases, there were cases in the late 30s in Missouri of swine that were found in mutilated condition in conjunction with a UFO sighting, actually, in one case.
Uh-huh.
A guy named Leon Sale had a very interesting experience as a kid on his grandfather's farm, and they saw an object fly over and appear to land a ways away from the house, and they went down there, found a landing circle, spun into the field, and a pig that was in a pen there had been mutilated. There's another case in the late 40s, early 50s of some elk hunters in Washington State who again had a sighting of an unusual object, went up to where they had seen it the following morning and found an elk mutilated. You know, I could go on and on. There was a case in the Middle Ages in England where, you know, some of the peasants were petitioning King James to, you know, do something about these strange, you know, animal deaths that were occurring out in the countryside. And so, you know, I mean, if you look hard enough, you're going to find some interesting reports. I think Charles Fort had some interesting cases involving animals in Africa. Again, you know, I'd have to check my notes. You know, you're kind of pulling
out. Yeah, I understand.
But yeah, there have definitely been at least stories that have been written at the time. You know, I've always loved the fact that the first Australian film, which is, I think was done in 1905 or 1906, was called Haunt of the Billabong, and it was about strange sheep mutilations on you know, the ranching station in I think New Zealand.
But was that based on some actual story, or was it just a story?
No, it was the first film ever filmed in Australia.
Was that based on some actual story, or?
Well, again, you know, it's really, I've done quite a bit of digging on this, and yeah, it is based on something, but I've never been able to really ascertain what the source of the original inspiration of, you know, whoever kind of formulated the screenplay. I don't know where they came up with that story, although there have been legends and stories that have equated strange animal deaths to be a real mystery and having occurred there in the late 19th century, early 20th century. But again, you know, this stuff, you God, if somebody wanted to pay me to go ahead and
tell
this stuff, man, I'd be right there with it. But you only have so many hours in the day, and, you know,
I'm
pretty good on the net, and I'm real good in archives and stuff. But, you know, God, I wish I had about 3 research assistants and a budget, you know.
We've got 20 minutes till I want to take a break here, and I wanted to kind of wrap up the place we left off last time.
Okay.
With the you described what appeared to be ritual mutilation and some of the ideas behind that, why that might be happening, and you said you wanted to get into how you came to that conclusion, what you saw,
yeah,
who you talked to, and what sort of led you in that direction.
Okay, yeah, that's. I'm not sure how far we progressed initially in our first conversation in that area, but I'll do a quick recap and then maybe go into a little bit more in depth.
We kind of touched on it right at the end, and it seemed to intrigue enough people that I wanted to bring it up again. Me too. I mean, I wanted to find out how you came to these conclusions.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You want me to start right now?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay. I thought we were taking a break.
No. We'll take a break in about 15 minutes.
You know, I when I first got involved in researching, you know, animal mutilations or livestock deaths, whatever you want to call them, because they were occurring right in my neighborhood, I wanted to find out as much as I could about the history of these types of reports. And of course, I remembered, you know, in high school, reading stories and maybe seeing an occasional local news story about these cattle mutilations that were occurring supposedly all over the West. And often in the newspaper coverage, you would see that the reporter or editor, whoever was involved in writing the headline, would often equate the occult with these cattle deaths, like cultists blame for unusual livestock deaths, or Satanists, good Satanists have killed this cow, and, you know, just interesting headlines like that that would fairly blatantly point a finger of blame at some sort of occult group.
Right.
Well, there was never, in my knowledge at the time in the 70s, I never saw any evidence to back up these assertions in the articles. And when I started really full-time investigating this whole morass in the early 90s, of course, I went back to the top researchers in the whole field, Thomas Adams, Dave Perkins, Linda Moulton Howe, who arrived later on, Gabe Valdez, Tommy Bland, Peter Jordan. There was a handful of people that were real knowledgeable about these events. And
right.
Had documented their spread through the early 70s from the upper Midwest down into the Midwest and then all across the western half of the country, with very few cases in California, interestingly. And again, when these cases first start out in a region, I noticed that initially the papers and the press would blame Satanists or some sort of a cult group. And then as the cases spread, then you'd hear reports of helicopters and maybe it's the government, and then occasionally you'd have that UFO sighting. Of course, UFOs were factored into the equation. But they always seemed, when the first cases started, at least in my estimation, this is, you know, all based on my insight into this whole thing, you would initially see the, you know, attributing these cases to some sort of occult-style perpetrator. Well, doing quite a bit of research over the years, I've been able to locate some interesting cases that again, fall into the pattern of being initial cases in a particular wave in an area, and where hooded figures were seen, or some sort of occult sign was seen, or ritual fires would be found, or strange kind of symbols would be left behind, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Mystery Stalks the Prairie is a very hard to get book written
right.
by a county sheriff up in Montana named Keith Warburton.
Right.
And he mentioned some very interesting occult tinged sightings of rogue individuals that were seen in an area where cattle were found. And David Perkins was involved in investigating some cases in the Huerfano Valley where, again, rogue figures were seen in and around mutilation sites. Now, why someone would equate, you know, rogue figures with the occult is interesting in and of itself, but again, these are sort of knee-jerk descriptions that would lead one, you know, to knee-jerk think that maybe, you know, some sort of ritual magic going on.
People look for an explanation very quickly when they people look for an explanation very quickly when confronted with something unknown or frightening or whatever.
To, lead towards the most convenient, you know.
Yeah, just the way people are.
Whatever
yeah.
eyewitness evidence.
Unfortunately.
Physical evidence, whatever. But one case that really struck me and made an impression on me was right in the area where the actually it was the ranch right where the uncle of the chief of police of Cuesta, New Mexico picked up the mystery hitchhiker. It was right there at the Tres Vitos Ranch where the first of over 40 cases occurred, and these cases occurred over about a 6-year period, and the first ones featured some very interesting ritual occult sign, and so much so that it scared the bejesus back into the ranch manager, who became a devout born-again Christian, and I'm still in touch with him. And he's, you know, was quite a meticulous documentarian, was able to write down dates and times and descriptions of these cases, and I find it very interesting that right when these ritual occult cases were occurring in the spring of, I think it was 93 or 92, I'd have to check my notes, but that's when that mystery hitchhiker was spotted, which is right in that same time period.
Yeah, in the same area, in the same time period.
There may be, even though we've never had any evidence other than anecdotal stuff and you know, coincidental descriptions, you know, aside, we've never really had any hard evidence to really support the, you know, that conjecture. But I've been, you know, again, privy to some information from law enforcement that mentions a group that supposedly is investigating for Congress, is investigating the animal death phenomenon, and does suspect some sort of ritual, high-tech equipped group that's out there doing some sort of ritual magic. And evidently it's known about at, you know, fairly high levels in government. And, you know, at the risk of revealing sources at this point before all this information has been published, I can safely say that these are fairly pretty hard not to consider as reputable sources of information. I mean, one guy is an actual famous law enforcement officer who's an expert in ritual crime. Made this claim, and you know,
it sounds like it's even weird. It sounds like it's even weirder than he expected.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's his bias, but the thing is...
Well, it was one cop going to a seminar, a training session that was being given by this noted, you know, homicide detective, and when he found out that the guy was from the San Luis Valley, he says, oh, that's where all the cattle mutilations take place, and he started to talk to him about it. And that's where the information came out. The gentleman who imparted this information to me is the chief investigator for a DA, district attorney. So, you know, we're not talking just some next-door neighbor saying, man, you wouldn't believe this. I mean, we're talking, you know, high up in the community law enforcement people.
Somebody who should be fairly skeptical about it.
Pardon me?
Somebody who should be fairly skeptical about it.
Yeah, well.
well, skeptical that of the fact that there could be something bigger than just weirdos running around in
well,
know,
that's,
small
that's the
groups.
Information that was imparted to me. There's no way in heck that a you know, some fly by night occult group, you know, wannabe occult group could pull off a
right.
dozen attacks in four states in the same night.
Uh-huh.
As we were seeing back in the mid-70s, at the height of the mutilation wave in the 70s and 75, the fall of 75, there was hundreds of cases happening, possibly even dozens a night. Somebody, you know, some group that's very well funded and has a very, you know, an infrastructure, logistical support, and a rhyme and a reason, some sort of, you know, program of action that was involved in doing this at the height of it, and probably still is involved doing it. This does seem to be real slick operators that are doing this, and I've come to the conclusion that there's some sort of link between the ritual blood sacrifice element that won't go away, even though there's no evidence besides what I've pretty much mentioned here, no evidence to support it. I do sense that there is a very, very valid connection between ritual blood sacrifice, the ancient practice of it that goes
right.
back thousands of years, and these modern day cattle mutilations. I do feel there's a connection. I feel they only represent a very small percentage of real cases. Most of these cases, as we discussed, you know, last month or whenever, you know, we discussed the possibility that these are environmental monitoring teams that are going out and doing it for a different purpose, to ascertain the spread of prion disease
right.
in cattle herds. But this ritual group tends to respond to those initial high strange cases where either UFOs or some sort of weird paranormal events tend to accompany these deaths. Then you have these response teams. It appears to me, my opinion, you have
right.
these response teams that go out and either close down a portal or placate some sort of, you know, non-defined or as yet undefined super predator, whatever the heck it is. They respond to it and try to shut whatever it is down, and then you have this blossoming of cases that are more mundane, that aren't done with high heat, that aren't, you know, high strange, that appear to be done possibly by humans. And I just find myself out, you know, kind of on a limb with this whole subject and this angle
right.
with the rest of the investigation community. I mean, nobody wants to talk about this. Even the people that talk about this stuff don't want to talk about this aspect of it. So
it's not brought up in polite
ahead of the curve maybe on it.
Not brought up in polite company at cattle mutilation conferences or parties.
No, it does come up at parties when I'm there, but not usually. I'm not the one to bring it up, believe me, especially around dinner. It's just not a popular dinner or dessert conversation.
Exactly.
You know, I've seen a couple hundred of these type of cases, and out of those, I firmly believe that 40 of them were real, and out of those 40, 3 or 4 were super high strange. And, you know, it's kind of hard to have that sort of experience under your belt, not, you know, not totally be bought into the whole idea that there is definitely something going on, no question about it. It's just trying to get to the bottom of it and trying to divvy up responsibility where it should go. And again,
right.
most investigators do not want to factor in any sort of ritual blood sacrifice into the equation because it's quite frankly too scary. The whole
yeah.
subject matter is scary enough. You know, and I've often wondered that maybe some of these cases are being done for humankind's benefit, and maybe we shouldn't be questioning it. Maybe we should just go along with it because it's okay. It's being done for our good, you know.
Yeah,
you kind of get to a point where you're not sure how much you should push and how deep you should dig.
Right.
Because, you know, maybe I'm not ready to find out what's there to be found out, you know, and question my motivations a little. You know, I've done quite a bit of thinking about this whole subject matter, and if I hadn't been so, you know, intimately involved in investigating many of these cases, I probably wouldn't have lasted as long as I have in the field. If it was just a peripheral interest and I'd never gone out on a case, I doubt that I'd be near as interested. Boy, it's like kissing a tar baby once you've seen a few of these things.
Right.
You know, you talk to law enforcement, you talk to taxidermists and to butchers and to ranchers and people that know this.
Mm-hmm.
Know that there's something very odd, strange about these deaths.
Well,
it's only when you do that that you really get hooked and kiss the old tar baby.
Right. Well, Chris, I wanted to take a break here for probably about 5 minutes, and maybe we can start up when we come back with one of these extremely high strangeness cases, and you can talk us through that, and maybe one that's connected to in some way to this ritual blood sacrifice thing. I'm sorry to hit that one so much, but we only got into it a little bit last time. And then we'll go into other things about media that's come out and talked to you, what happened with them.
Okay, you're fading out on me. I didn't hear much of that last paragraph. But
I said we'll talk about we'll come back and talk about one of those high strangeness cases or a couple of them, and how they might be connected to this blood sacrifice thing or not. And then we can move on to your experience with media coming out there and old and new ufology, what you're working on now, and your collaboration with Ray Stanford here.
Right.
Okay. So what,
boy, that's a whole show, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we do have about an hour left, so we'll be back here in about 5 minutes and talking with Chris O'Brien here about cattle mutilations and many other things. Radio Mysterioso.
In your mind, you have capacities, you know, to telepath messages through the vast unknown. Please close your eyes and concentrate with every thought you think upon the recitation we're about to say. Interplanetary, most extraordinary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft.
there's a little bit of calling occupants of interplanetary craft by the Carpenters, played more than a few times on this show. Chris, are you back with us?
I'm back.
Oh, great. And I don't even have any buzz on the line here. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to position things a bit better so that you can hear me when I talk. Right before we left, oh, this is Radio Misterioso, by the way, Sundays 8 to 10 p.m. here on killradio.org. When we left a few minutes ago, I was asking you about some of the particularly high strangeness cases, as we call them, and how you determine those to be such, and also how those might be related in some way to this forbidden idea of ritual sacrifice associated with the cattle mutilation phenomenon.
Well, again, as I sort of preface the entire subject, there is very little evidence to support my hunch or my intuitive hit on a small percentage of these cases being perpetrated for the express purpose of placating or in supplication to some sort of preternatural predator that's out there, whether it's aliens from another planet, the high-tech chefs coming back to harvest illegal animals,
yeah,
dinners, meta-terrestrials coming from the 8th through 11th dimensions, time travelers, ultra-terrestrials from under the ocean or, you know, under the Rocky Mountains. I don't know what these, where these beings are coming from or entities or predators are, you know, where they are from. But there does seem to be, at the core of the mutilation phenomenon, some sort of supernatural, paranormal predator at work. And the patterning of helicopter activity and what appears to be government interest in these animal deaths tends to lead me in the direction that the government is constantly reacting to something. In the initial, again, cases, that may be the beginning of a wave of activity. Later on, they become actively involved and proactive in performing these experiments. But initially, I think that there is a reactive element that's involved. Something you don't read about in the very few books that do cover the mutilation phenomenon, but
yeah,
one thing that you will not see in there is that you know that there's some sort of reactive program in place. And the obvious conclusion that I can make, or you know, jump that I can make, is that they are reacting to something because they either need to head it off at the pass, somehow placate it, or make it not angry, or try to make it go away. There's like closing down a doorway or an access point is the closest descriptive way I can sum up my intuition on this. And again, there's very little evidence to support this. However, at the beginning of several waves, we have seen some ritual sign. We have we had descriptions of strange, you know, like I said, hooded figures, cloaked figures, fires. Animals arrayed in particular patterns. I had one case at the foot of La Magna Pass, which is right on the border of Colorado and New Mexico, up at about 9,000 feet or so. These people pulled off onto a dirt road, a forest road, and were going back to have a picnic and found this mutilated animal. And the several of the organs that had been excised from the animal were in a plastic bag hanging from a tree over the animal. And the animal's head had been taken off and used as a candle holder. And a burnt candle was, you know, snuffed out, you know, half-burnt candle was found on the animal's head. Now, this would appear to me to be some sort of amateur wannabe types, cult types doing this. But interesting that they should pick a cow, number one, or a bull, rather, in this case. And interesting,
yeah,
that they should go to the trouble to, you know, perform apparently some sort of ritual around the dead animal. You know, when you think about it, I mean, man's relationship or human's relationship with cattle and bovines is thousands of years old. Cattle, besides the dog, was the first domesticated animal. Human hemoglobin, human blood, the constituent elements of human blood, are a virtual genetic match to cattle blood. Cattle are much closer genetically in terms of their hemoglobin
than any other animal, great apes, chimps, dolphins, whatever. You could almost survive a transfusion of cattle hemoglobin, relatively speaking, to any other animal. And I find that as a potential major clue that might, potentially give us some insight into why 90% of these livestock deaths or animal deaths reported are cattle. And I think the fact that cattle hemoglobin is such a virtual match to human hemoglobin is again, very, I think, important. Some of the ancient cultures and their belief systems surrounding cattle, the Mithra cults, which was the other religion, basically, around the first century, vying for popularity with Christianity, which was a very upstart, you know, new religion at the time. The Mithra cults basically revered cattle. The Minoans on the island of Minos, of course, the famous Minotaur and the labyrinths of Minos, and worship cattle. They had acrobats that would, instead of, you know, doing the Latin American style of you know, or Spanish style of bullfighting, they would do acrobatic leaps and run right at a charging bull, spring up into the air, do a handspring over its back, and do these incredible feats of athletic prowess.
Oh yeah, there's actually engravings, friezes, and paintings.
Yeah,
of that.
Some really interesting frescoes that have been discovered with these types of images.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the Mithra cults again. When you were baptized in the blood of the bull, you were in a pit underneath an animal that was slaughtered by hand above you, and the blood washed down and baptized you. Christianity, of course, adopted that concept with the
baptism,
you know, the instead of the blood of the bull became the blood of the lamb, and you were baptized, but, you know, with water. And some of the major tenets of the Mithra cults or Mithra belief system were incorporated into early Christianity. And